The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back. Plus, no payments for 90 days. And take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
Too Much Information is a production of iHeartRadio. Hello everyone, and welcome to Too Much Information, the show that gives you the secret histories and little-known fascinating facts behind your favorite movies, music, TV shows, and more. My name is Jordan Runtog.
And I am the Naz with God-given ass.
Yes, you are. And in case that hint doesn't clue you in, today we're focusing on something very near and dear to both of our hearts, and many others as well. Of all the pop culture monoliths we've examined on this show so far, I'm probably hard-pressed to name one that has such a special place in people's hearts, with the possible exception of Baby Got Back. To call this one of the most influential albums in history is underselling it a little bit from my perspective. More important than all the trails that it blazed across music, fashion, performance art, and visual design, it's provided encouragement to generations of people who felt out of step or othered. In so many cases, this album gave people the strength to embrace their inner freak and unapologetically be themselves, just like the man who made it. I'm talking about David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, which turns 50 years old this week. Heigl, in our Stairway to Heaven episode, you talked about Chuck Klosterman's theory that every guy, or at least a certain type of guy, goes through a Led Zeppelin phase. And I'd argue that most artistically inclined, sensitive people that I know went through a Ziggy Stardust phase at one time or another. Did you?
I was a total dilettante until basically my mid-20s. I mean, I had Changes, because that was what my dad had, the greatest hits. And I loved it. I don't know why. I was an idiot. I was like, I love all this. I will not investigate further. like a total dummy. These are some of my favorite songs. I'm sure there's nothing else out there. So it wasn't until like my mid-20s that I started really getting into like Scary Monsters and the Berlin trilogy and like, you know, just the massive Bowie. And I didn't really check out until the 90s, like him. And I think it was when he died that it just sort of crystallized, like, I f***ed up. Because he came through Pennsylvania, I had all these opportunities to see him, and I didn't. And it was like, you know, really watching all the tributes roll in and seeing people write so movingly about what he meant to them that I was like, oh, yes, yes, he is an all-timer, and I whiffed this. I whiffed my fandom. So, yeah, late blooming Bowie fan, but very much one still.
That's so funny you mentioned that. For somebody who's as into music as you are and I am, I had almost the exact same experience. My exposure to Bowie was really weird because there was such a cult around him in my high school in the early 2000s. And to me, he just became like another t-shirt artist, which was like just somebody that you liked. And it said more about who you wanted to portray yourself as rather than actually liking this artist. And it was just became like a sort of fashion signifier, like the Dark Side of the Moon logo or the Grateful Dead bears at my high school. And as a result, I really delayed in listening to all those artists for reasons that I really can't articulate. It was a sense of like,
I mean, the classic rock industrial complex kind of ruins this stuff for
you.
And it's because
it's hard
just
to
like,
find it on your own and come to it on your own.
It's just like ambiently in the air so much that you're like, oh, I know all there is. Like, I've heard those songs a million times. I know about them. And then you don't because you're an idiot and you're 17. So it's like, yeah. But no, I'm with you. And so, do you remember when he died? Were we working? We were both at People when he died, right?
No, it was just before I got there. Actually, this is really weird. Oh, Bowie kind of popped up in my life in a really weird way. The first Rolling Stone piece I was ever asked to write was the day Bowie died. And that, right? Yeah, it was a strange mix of like, oh my God, this is terrible. And oh my God, I'm rolling for Rolling Stone. Like any kid who grew up watching Almost Famous was a dream come true. So he's just always kind of been this strange presence that's popped up in my life, almost like that episode of Flight of the Conchords. I had this friend who would describe Bob Dylan's work to another friend who wasn't really into him at the time was, when you're ready to receive Bob, he will make himself known to you. And that's how I sort of feel about Bowie. He always kind of popped up. The day he died was really the day that I started diving into him in a serious way, actually, for that piece. And then a few years later, the folks at iHeart asked me to write a biography podcast about him. This is a shameless plug for that.
Good.
It's called Off the Record, David Bowie. And it's 14 hours long. It took up a year of my life.
Jordan went insane while he was writing this. I was in touch with him the entire time, and it was worth it.
Oh, well, thank
it's
you.
It's so good.
I mean, it's 14 hours long, and it was written from April 2020 to May 2021, so the peak dark days of the pandemic, and Bowie, in addition to sort of driving me insane, also got me through these really tough days. So I feel in a funny way that I've gotten to know him, and I've become extremely fond of him ever since. And, for that project, I interviewed so many fans and artists who worked with him. And they really, Bowie people are like some of the best fans I've ever known. Just the biggest hearts. Yeah. And yeah, so that really was just such a cool experience. So Bowie people are the best. And I hope we do them proud with this episode, which, Bowie broke so many boundaries and defied so many expectations. So in keeping with that same bold spirit of innovation, we're delivering our very first two-part Too Much Information episode.
Bam, 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 bam.
Exactly. We really hope you enjoy it. From the eccentric reclusive rock stars who inspired the character of Ziggy to the legendary piano used on the Sessions, the funny connection between Starman and the Wizard of Oz, and the moment Freddie Mercury stood front row center for Ziggy's grand unveiling, here's part one of Everything You Never Knew About Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. I can't do spiders.
I'm going to at some point.
Oh, please, yeah.
The webs from all spiders. Catching things in there inside. Oh, boy. It'll come up again.
Oh, I'm sure it will.
Organically.
So it's early 1971, and David Bowie is at a crossroads. We have to start every episode when possible with the artist at a crossroads. He's been trying to break into the music business since 1965, which a lot of people don't realize. He put in the work, and he's changed his musical poses again and again to adapt to the prevailing tastes and trends of the time, starting with early mod-style R&B groups in the mid-60s with names like the Manish Boys and the King Bees, which are both named for blues standards. And he dropped his self-titled debut album in 1967 on the same day the Beatles dropped Sgt. Pepper, and they both have a similar talk about getting eclipsed. And they both have the sort of similar psychedelic carnival music hall feel. And by 1969, he'd entered into his freak folk troubadour phase with stuff like Space Oddity, where he cashed in on the Apollo 11 moon landing. And that brought him to like the closest he ever had come to having a hit, really. And then by the dawn of the 70s, he teamed up with guitarist Mick Ronson and amped up his sound, sort of like Led Zeppelin and The Who, for the album The Man Who Sold the World, which flopped spectacularly upon its release, despite being a really sort of FM-friendly sound with that heavy rock and roll. This is a super broad overview and a gross oversimplification of Bowie's oeuvre, Bowie's canon to this point. But by 1971, it very much looked like he was destined to be a one-hit wonder on par with, Zagger and Evans or Barry Maguire in terms of, like, late 60s.
Dare you slander Barry Maguire?
Moody, doomy, apocalyptic songs. And then he conceived of his alien alter ego, Ziggy. And this would not have happened were it not for two trips, literal, not chemical trips, that he took this year, 1971, to America.
It is such a shame that Man Who Sold the World flopped, because that record...
It's a crazy record.
...is like a sneaky... It's a sneaky contender for one of his most influential. Obviously, the big thing off of it is the title track, because Nirvana covered it. But yeah, man, it's a bummer. I remember the band I was in when he died, we got invited to do like two songs at a tribute set, and we did Suffragette City, which killed, but then we did Black Country Rock, because that song has such a killer riff that we were just like, we were so into that, and it went over like the proverbial lead balloon. People were just like, this is a Bowie song? So I have a soft spot for Man Who Sold the World.
That is a great record. It's one that's so unexpected. I mean, especially when heard against Hunky Dory, which came next, yeah, which is like a McCartney solo record. It's all piano-based. But yeah, incredible album. So David Bowie may have been English, but Ziggy Stardust was born in America. In many ways, the United States was David Bowie's spiritual home. It's gleefully excessive, larger than life, and filled with contradiction. You could say the same about Bowie. You could be whoever you wanted in the United States. I think that was really what differentiated it from the UK at this time. And this place had mesmerized David since he was a little boy. I mean, growing up in England, all culture was American, you know, I mean, from Disney movies, hamburgers, Coca-Cola, Elvis. It just seemed like America's chief export was pop culture. So his first trip to the United States in February 1971 was a big deal. And fittingly, it was in Hollywood, the land of make-believe and movie stars, where anything seemed possible, that the Ziggy Stardust notion really began to take root, and he sketched early notes for it on hotel stationery and cocktail napkins. And initially, the Ziggy Stardust idea was conceived as a Broadway-style production, and the score was going to serve as a new album. And this was because, from Bowie's perspective, rock and roll had become, by 1971, really dull. And he felt that it embraced showmanship, but not theatricality. And despite the recent spate of rock operas like The Who's Tommy and The Pretty Things' SF Sorrow and Arthur by the Kinks, he thought that all the other elements like clothes and set design and lights and dance moves and acting were all treated as secondary to the music, if they were attended to at all. And David wanted to incorporate all of these things. And he'd recently caught a performance by Alice Cooper, who was sort of the new gender-bending shock rocker on the scene at the time. And he was extremely not impressed by the whole electric chair, straitjacket, boa constrictor routine. In fact, he later said that he felt embarrassed for Alice because he basically seemed like so much of a tryhard. Yeah, he said, this is a quote, "I think he's trying to be outrageous," David said at the time. "You can see him, poor dear, with his red eyes sticking out and his temples straining. He tries so hard. I find him very demeaning. It's all so premeditated."
That is rich coming from Bowie, by the way. But I would just like to take issue with that for a number of reasons. One, while Alice Cooper is pretty firmly lodged in the popular consciousness for like the decapitated baby shtick and the shock rocker thing, sort of being this Marilyn Manson precursor, a lot of the early press around him that Bowie would have been reading around this time centered around the gender stuff. The naming convention of naming this band, and by the way, his early band was called the Spiders, so Spiders!
Yeah. Spiders count stands at...
Yeah, ding! They talked about this all the time. John Mendelsohn, Entertainment World, who would also go and write about Bowie, said of Alice Cooper, he looked like a nightmare vision of unisex run amok. In Life in 1971, there was an article starring him called Rock in the Androgynous Zone. Also from that year in Crawdaddy, there was an article called Alice Cooper, Are You a Boy or Are You a Girl? In Milwaukee Journal, there was one called Alice Cooper of Freaky Rock Fame is Just an All-American Boy Girl. And he's been really written out, I think. And it's, you know, as early as 1969, he was saying in a magazine called Poppin', people don't accept that they are both male and female, and people are afraid to break out of their sex thing because that's a big insecurity that's doing that. So I think I just want to give some shouts to Alice Cooper, and I think Bowie slamming him is Bowie trying to distance himself from someone who, as with many other people, he would promptly rip off. That's my Alice Cooper shtick. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
Thank you for that. That's stirring defense.
Also, those records slap.
Yeah. So this LA trip was in February of 1971, and in September of that same year, Bowie traveled to America again to sign his new deal with RCA Records. And this label was home to Elvis Presley, who was Bowie's birthday twin, in addition to being, you know, the king of rock and roll, and he saw himself as the heir to the king's throne. And all in all, this trip to New York was a big deal for Bowie, and he had some new friends that he wanted to meet in town. The cast of a very, very, very off-Broadway show called Pork. Heigl, tell us about Pork. I want you to really...
Well, they don't teach pork in drama school. It has been described somewhat uncharitably, but not inaccurately, as an orgy with arty dialogue. The script had been heavy scare quotes, written by Andy Warhol, culled from over 200 plus hours of recorded phone conversations with the factory kids, who were also in the cast. And this was such a common thing around this time. I mean, that's whole Lou Reed's whole thing was just jotting down stuff that he heard around the factory and making it into songs. And it's very hand in hand with Andy Warhol's literally factory, like industrial approach to art. Like, well, we got to make a play now. I've got all these conversations laying around. This is now the play. We have a play. Anyway, these are just some of the wildest people alive in this. They talk about it extensively in Please Kill Me, which is the punk oral history. Just flashing their boobs during performances. The plot of this thing has full frontal nudity, masturbation, homosexuality, douching on stage, simulated coprophagia with chocolate pudding subbed in as the real thing. I felt dirty just reading that. The run lasted a scant few weeks in the heady summer of 1971, but somehow they got an offer to perform in England, which is like...
The English something was lost in the translation.
Yeah,
there.
The English didn't know. It was probably just the Warhol thing, right? They were like, oh, yeah. Andy Warhol. The English didn't know it hit him. An actress flashed reporters outside of the Queen's palace. Other cast members were busted having sex in the bathroom of a pub.
Yeah.
Yeah, that tracks. It seemed only natural that such free-spirited attention seekers would find their way to Bowie. In fact, they were some of the few Americans who actually knew who he was. They had read David's first major profile in Rolling Stone earlier that year, and they were intrigued by the photos of David looking very androgynous in his long hair and, quote, man dress. So it reminds me of this anecdote about Iggy Pop, where his lawyer came and picked him up from jail, like out of the drunk tank or whatever, and he was wearing a dress, and he enters the cell and he goes, Iggy, why are you wearing a woman's dress? And Iggy pulls himself up and like dusts himself off and he says, I beg your pardon. This is a man's dress. And walks out. Yeah, so this cast of the Warhol Factory Freaks, they hit England, they decide to look up Bowie, and you put this akin to, what's her name, from the basis of Legally Blonde, writing all of her stuff on pink paper. Like, if you put yourself out there, the right people will find you.
And be the most authentically you, and yes, it will attract the right people and the right kind of attention, and you will be seen for exactly who you are. I think this is another great example of that.
And this next anecdote will undo everything that you just said, because they were not impressed with David Bowie and the version of himself he was at the time. He was kind of in this transitional folky phase. He was wearing baggy pants, his big hat, and doing an acoustic set. And I think the quote from one of the Warhol scenesters was they loved Angela because she was like pregnant, yeah, and like behaving really outrageously. And they
American. And so she had that kind of like, I interviewed a few of these factory people, Cherry Vanilla and Tony Zanetta. And they both said the same thing, that David, I think the word they used was kind of a drip. Like, he was very quiet. And I mean, because he was a shy guy. I mean, that's the thing that they would always remark on, was he had the capacity, kind of like Marilyn Monroe, to just turn it on. And everyone in the room would just turn their head to him when he didn't do anything, you know, perceptively, but just his whole energy would change. But he could also just completely disappear if he wanted to also. So, yeah, that's kind of what they said. But he was in this kind of awkward phase stylistically and, you know, fashion-wise, but also they kind of got him in a shy, shy mode. But it's funny because they go see David's concert and they're just thoroughly not impressed by this kind of folky drip that they see on the stage. And then they invite him to go see their play. And, you know, it's like Leonardo DiCaprio on Titanic. Like, want to go to a real party? And then he sees everything you described on stage from, you know, homosexuality on stage, douching, etc. And this completely shattered his mind because it had only been 3-4 years since there had been a censor board that had to approve all plays that were performed in England. I mean, so this was just, you know, this was 4 years after homosexuality had been decriminalized. I mean, that's right. What we're working with here.
Yeah. And the kind of gritty urban grossness that they represented was like a longtime obsession for him. And he read beat poetry. He read the Kerouac novels. He loved Velvet Underground.
And so to see this seriously underground stuff suddenly performed on stage, especially after David had spent so much of his youth, you know, reading all the beat poets and Kerouac, and as you mentioned, Velvet Underground's music, and, you know, John Retchie's City of Night and stuff like that, this completely blew his mind.
So he went to see Pork repeatedly and got close with the cast. And in fact, within a year, many of them would be on his payroll, essentially. The other thing that he got from them was the notion of being on. Always be closing, always be on. So Jane County would later say, "We kind of took David under our wing and we all decided to help him out, you know, glam him up and make him more outrageous." We can quibble over whether or not, over their role. I know some of these factory types are great reverse rememberers.
Yeah, they do resent him because a lot of their slang expressions and stuff would show up in his song lyrics, and he did borrow a lot from them, but yeah, their influence on him and his, you know, has been kind of overstated a little bit.
Yes, in your saying. No, I don't know. Okay, so I'm just going from the Please Kill Me thing, because Jane County does talk about, she fronted this proto-punk band called the Electric Chairs, and they were sort of the also-rans of the Maxis Kansas City and CBGB scene. Like, they were this really wild band, but they never really caught on in the same way that a lot of their other peers from that scene did. And she has been very adamant about her influence on Bowie. You know, she says in Please Kill Me, "David loved my songs, and so I sent him my demos. He loved them and wanted more, so I sent him 3 sets of demos. Man Enough to Be a Woman, Are You a Boy or Are You a Girl, Queen Age Baby. He wanted to take me into the studio and produce an album, so I sent all my music, and little bits and pieces started showing up on his albums." So, her words. So the castmates, obviously understating this somewhat, but Pork made quite the impression on David. And so when he gets to New York, he decides to look them up. And with them, Andy Warhol.
Yeah, it's kind of inevitable that the cast of Pork brought David to Warhol's factory to meet Andy himself. And, you know, you think of it now, this could have been one of the great artistic summits of the 70s, but it was pretty awkward and painful. This was just a few years after the assassination attempt on Warhol's life in 1968, and security at the factory had been ramped up, and the vibes were really bad. He had to ring a doorbell marked "Do not ring," and then Bowie and his sort of small entourage were grilled by Andy's guards. Just bad vibes. And when Andy finally appeared, he was for some reason clad in jodhpurs, high-laced boots, and a riding crop. Which I'm sure added to the weird vibes. And yeah, much like Alice Cooper, David was not impressed with Andy Warhol. He would later recall, "I met this man who was the living dead, yellow in complexion, a wig on that was the wrong color, little glasses. I extended my hand and the guy retired. So I thought, this guy doesn't like flesh. Obviously he's reptilian." And yeah,
what a weird thing to say.
Right, yeah. I mean, neither man were known for being especially chatty, and Warhol just completely thwarted any attempts to make small talk. And this was just kind of his way. He was just not the most socially tactful person. But David took it really personally. You know, he wanted to be taken seriously by Warhol as a peer. And so he viewed this as rejection. And so David tried to break the ice by playing a new song he'd written and he'd recorded, but it wasn't out yet, called Andy Warhol, which would be on Hunky Dory. And he played it for Andy, played it for the, you know, the man who inspired it. And Warhol listened for a minute before sort of absently wandering away. And then a few minutes later, one of the factory flunkies came over and informed David that Andy hated the song that he named for him. which is amazing. I mean, I guess the only thing that Warhol actually liked about Bowie were the bright yellow patent leather shoes that he had on. And
hell yeah.
He was so intrigued that he grabbed the Polaroid and just began photographing the shoes obsessively, inches away from the shoes and not even making eye contact with David, which is incredible. And before David left, he took part in one of Warhol's famous screen tests, where guests are placed in front of a camera and encouraged to do whatever comes to mind. It's basically a video portrait. And David, who had this extensive background in mime, acted out his own disembowelment, just ripping his guts out bit by bit. You can see this on YouTube. I've seen it before. Maybe it's in a documentary. But yeah, this disembowelment, as far as he was concerned, that was kind of a physical manifestation of what this visit was like for him.
Can you imagine being one of the, like, lesser-known factory flunkies who's almost assuredly on acid at this point, and, like, this is the scene that you're confronted with? Like, this tall, alien-looking stranger comes in, plays Andy Warhol a song about Andy Warhol, and then has his shoes obsessively photographed, and then acts out his own disembowelment. I mean, that would put me off drugs for the rest of my life.
I mean, think about being the one who had to go inform Bowie that Andy hated his song, Andy
yeah,
Warhol.
Right.
I mean, that's arguably worse. So
that's true.
All in all, this meeting with Warhol, kind of a bust, but thankfully things went slightly better when David met another of Warhol's associates, Mr. Lou Reed.
I love Lou.
I know,
I mean, he's such a cantankerous, especially around this point of his life.
But. Oh, big time. I mean, yeah, this was the period when Lou is basically in a self-imposed state of exile from music and living out on Long Island with his parents, and I think working as a typist in his father's...
Yeah, his dad was an accountant.
Yeah. So, not a great time to meet Lou Reed, I suppose, but Bowie was thrilled because this is just one of his heroes. And it's interesting, Bowie got passed an advance copy of the Velvet Underground's debut back in 1966, becoming probably one of the very first people, if not the first person in England to ever hear it. His manager at the time had brought it back over during a business trip in New York. And Bowie just devoured the album. I mean, this was like Kerouac's books put to music. And he incorporated a few of the Velvet Underground songs into his early set. I mean, definitely making him the first person in England to cover stuff like Waiting for the Man and White Light, White Heat. And Bowie had visited New York on his first trip to America early that year, the same trip he went to L.A., and he made a point to go see the Velvet Underground downtown, and after the show, he snuck backstage and cornered the guy that he thought was Lou Reed and just fanboyed out. And after it was all over, he learned that the guy that he'd been fawning over was not Lou Reed, it was Lou Reed's replacement, Doug Yule.
Okay, though. Easy mistake to make, and in fact, one that I made when I was first downloading Velvet Underground songs off Kazaa, because Doug Yule's whole thing at this point was trying to sound, he idolized Lou when he came into the band, and sings he is a better version of Lou Reed's vocals. Like, Oh Sweet Nothing is yeah. like, that is such a beautiful performance, and he sounds like Lou. And if you read about them at this time, he had also started dressing like Lou, and they sort of looked, they were both just like, you know, mousy brunette guys, so it was like... This is before the internet. You don't know what Lou Reed looks like. You see a guy who sounds like him and you're seeing the Velvet Underground. I made the same mistake, David.
Okay. Well, remember this incident because the whole sense of stardom is just what people think you are mentality comes back later in the Ziggy Stardust story. But now Bowie is sharing a meal with the real Lou Reed, who again is just sort of a shadow of his former self at this point.
But what do they bond over?
They bond over... not really caring much for Andy Warhol. That was really, I mean, Lou during this dinner was kind of drunk and sullen, but the only time he brightened was when Bowie told him about this really awkward meeting with Warhol. And Warhol was famously the Velvet Underground's very hands-off manager for a time. And Lou joked that the Velvet Underground considered producing an Andy Warhol doll that had a string, and when you pulled the string, nothing happened.
So, but at this point, another massively important American in Bowie's life comes in, and that is Mr. Jim Osterberg, a.k.a. Iggy Pop. Lou decides to call it an early night, heads back to Long Island to his cloistered life of misery. But Iggy Pop shows up at Max's Kansas City, and Bowie was a big fan of Iggy and the Stooges. He cited him as his favorite singer in interviews, but more than the songwriting, it was the Iggy Pop persona that captivated him. And honestly, how could you not? There's this amazing bit Henry Rollins does about his like long-running feud with Iggy Pop that is completely one-sided. He just, when Rollins' band was like a thing, he was like
You mean Black
obsessed.
Flag? His band was like a thing?
No. Rollins' band. Yeah, no. So he has this very funny bit where he talks about he basically got blown off stage by Iggy Pop, and so he then made it his, as everyone did, yeah. And so he made it his mission to like train as physically hard as he could and like rehearse the band as much as he could to try and defeat Iggy Pop, and he just. He Fool's has this errand. Great quote. Yeah, exactly. Well, it is. But it's this masterful thing. It's on YouTube. You got to look it up. There's two bits in it that I love. One is he says, you know, there's Jim and there's Iggy. And Jim is just a nice guy from Ypsilanti, Michigan. Like, oh, hey, how you doing? Hey, real nice to see you. Great gig. And then there's Iggy Pop. And he's like, and you never know who you're going to get when it hits the stage. He talks about like seeing the Stooges or the band, whoever the band was at this point, like vamping on down in the street and like seeing a roadie holding a mic out at arm's length from backstage, like as far from the mic as physically possible, and seeing Iggy come sprinting from backstage, grabbing the mic and just like immediately start bleeding and like already shirtless and sweating. And he goes this whole thing about they played some festival and Iggy just like destroyed the stage and he invites the crowd up on there. And it's just a show stopping complete catastrophe, brings the whole festival to a halt, rock and roll incarnate. And he walks past Henry Rollins, who had played before him. He walks past Henry Rollins, like trots off stage. And as he's passing Henry Rollins, he looks at him and goes, huh? So Iggy Pop, rock and roll incarnate. But he's at a crossroads.
In 1971, he is at a crossroads. Like Bowie, he's at a crossroads.
Yeah, and on someone's couch. You know, the Stooges were never destined to be they were a sprint, not a marathon. The band split. Iggy was on heroin, extremely on heroin. He OD'd. He crashed the van. He was stranded in the Detroit projects at one point wearing a pink tutu. And by the summer of 71, he was crashing at his ex-manager's New York City apartment. And that is where he was on this very night when he got the call to come meet Bowie at Max's. But Iggy had no idea who Bowie was. And he was watching a Jimmy Stewart movie on TV. So he was busy and also on heroin. So he was finally persuaded to come down and meet Bowie. And they just hit it off. And why shouldn't they? They're both these quiet, intelligent, semi-retiring guys in their private lives who became these larger-than-life rock icons. I would also like to point out the other big New York formative punk influence on Bowie around this time, which is the New York Dolls.
Hmm.
Especially in the gender-bending department. You know, the New York Dolls kind of get cited as like an early, like the 77 kind of crew of punk, but they were really going around this time. And they were playing in all of these downtown spots. And I think it's in Please Kill Me Again that Lee Childers says that Bowie and Reed came to see them a lot this time, and their whole thing was like, it was like proto-punk stripped down rock and roll, and they were just a bunch of huge ungainly men in drag on stage. So all of the lodestars of New York City rock and roll are kind of converging on Bowie at this point.
We're gonna take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more Too Much Information in just a moment.
Today, I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gaginianaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
So you have these two trips to the United States. You know, if you think about it, the trip to Hollywood in February of 71, that provided the stardust, the whole, like, you know, dramatic onstage element. And then this trip to New York, that was the Ziggy. That was the, you know, as we mentioned later, a lot of people theorized that Ziggy was Iggy with a Z. But we'll get more on that later. So David gets back to England in the early fall of 71, and he begins to assemble his own custom-made superstar, Ziggy Stardust. And he holds up in his own version of Andy Warhol's factory, this giant, decrepit, gothic manor house called Haddon Hall that he rents with his wife, Angie, and little son, Zoe, and his bandmates who would become the Spiders from Mars, Mick Ronson, bassist Trevor Boulder, and drummer Woody Woodmansey.
That guy's f***ing name.
Yeah, I know. It's really hard to say.
The most British shit ever. Sorry. Woody Woodmansey. Yeah.
And this whole custom-made superstar notion was derived in large part from Andy Warhol, who was a painter who branched out into film and music. And he incorporated all these mediums into large-scale happenings, with a capital H, which were really some of the first full-scale multimedia events. And David wanted to go even further. And his idea was that his performance would become concept art. He wouldn't just exhibit a fantasy. He would inhabit that fantasy. And getting out there and singing songs to him was just boring. He felt that people didn't want a recital. They wanted a show. And Bowie promised to deliver this full package. And he had this great quote around this time. "I'm the last person to pretend that I'm a radio. I'd rather go out and be a color television set." Such a great line. And to explore this bold new concept, David decided to experiment on someone else. And this was another page right out of Warhol's playbook. He would create a superstar from scratch, and the band would be his canvas. David would write the songs, choose the clothes, pick their new names, and even provide the vocals. And it's really kind of a canny move, because without risking his own career, middling as it was at this time, David could experiment to his heart's content and discard the ideas that didn't work and cherry pick the ones that did for himself. And to continue the whole, you know, space metaphor, it's like NASA testing early rockets with dogs and apes. That's a terrible metaphor. And this one's even worse. For Bowie's personal ape, he recruited the the handsome and charismatic Freddie Beretti. Sorry, Freddie, for comparing you to an ape. A 19-year-old budding clothing designer that Bowie knew from London's gay club scene. And David rechristened Freddie Beretti as Rudy Valentino and steered him into the studio with a kind of ragtag group of musicians that Bowie called Arnold Korns. That was the name of this band, I guess.
That's awful.
It's a terrible name. Supposedly taken from his love of the Pink Floyd song Arnold Lane. But yeah, terrible, terrible band name. Now, in the annals of rock and roll history, the band Arnold Korns seldom gets a mention. And this is really not surprising. They released just two singles between 1971 and 1972, both of which are mediocre and both of which sank like stones on the charts. But despite their total lack of commercial success and their truly horrendous name, Arnold Korns deserves recognition because they were the prototype for Ziggy Stardust. The guy that Bowie hired to be the frontman, Freddie Beretti, he couldn't sing to save his life. So David went full Milli Vanilli and secretly sang on recordings of two of his new songs, Moon Age Daydream and Hang On to Yourself, both of which were destined for greatness on the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars album. But these early versions with Arnold Korns, they needed a lot of work. The tempos were kind of sluggish, and the vocal performances, I think the keys were wrong, and he sounded really kind of thin and reedy. It wasn't a good performance. So Arnold Korns, commercial flop, but by no means a failure, because it allowed Bowie to toy with alter egos and high-concept pop, and now he was ready to give it a shot on his own. But there was a problem. What was that problem?
The problem is David had just wrapped Hunky Dory, which is still a month out from being released. This is your favorite Bowie record because it's piano heavy, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, yeah. I like a lot of the Berlin stuff too. But yeah, I'd say this is the most McCartney-esque.
Fair. But it didn't fit his vision of this multimedia spectacle. And it also sort of didn't rock.
You don't get the crowd on their feet with, you know, there's no Starman. There's no, you know, 5 years on this. It's,
But RCA has socked money into it, but I guess they... Did they say that they didn't hear a hint on this, or they just said, we want more?
They just said, get back in the studio, we want more.
Yeah. God love them. So he returns to the studio to tackle basically a backlog of songs that he has.
This is before Hunky Dory is even out.
Yeah, which is, you know, under the sway of Stooges, Velvet Underground. And he told his producer, Ken Scott, I don't think you'll like this next album. It's much more rock and roll. You know, the other big... I don't know if he's an unsung hero. He's pretty much a sung hero, but, you know, Mick Ronson is like the MVP, the non-Bowie MVP category of this era. I mean,
he's his musical director, basically.
That guitar sound is, I mean, that guitar sound is so influential. They have created a pedal that just lets you replicate what he did with his wah pedal, which was, do you know about this?
It's like halfway up, right?
Yeah, they call it the cocked wah sound. I mean, what a wah pedal does is it sweeps through a frequency range, right? If you leave it in a certain position on this heel to toe spectrum, it'll stay as a sort of frequency mid-range boost. And, you know, Ronson, I think, is playing a Les Paul, which is traditionally a bit more of a bassy guitar. And so he parks his wah in this mid position. And what that does is it gives this really mid-rangey honk and bite to it. And it's become like just an archetypal. I mean, you can go to his studio and be like, I want that Mick Ronson sound. And so there is now a pedal that I think Electro Harmonix has created that is called the cocked wah, or some kind of cock name, and there's a rooster on it, and it just lets you get that wah sound with a one button pedal. So he's just a tremendously influential guy, and as you mentioned, the musical director. The sessions start at London's Trident Studios in November of 1971. Bowie gets bored so quickly. 2 or 3 takes to learn a new song before he would say, no, it's not working, and move on. Producer Ken Scott says 95% of these vocals are all first takes, which is wild. And Ronson finished his charts in the bathroom, usually like 10 minutes before they were slated to record, because they were on that much of a time crunch. And that's why this, I mean, yeah, it's a live sounding record. It's a raw sounding record. It does not sound like Music Hall. It doesn't sound like Cabaret. It sounds like sweat, work. And now, Jordan's piano sidebar. Speaking of Cabaret.
This is not a very piano-centric album, unlike Hunky Dory, but I wanted to give a quick shout-out to the piano at the studios that they were using, Trident Studios, because it's arguably one of the most important instruments in rock. It's a Bechstein concert-sized grand piano, and it was used on the Beatles' Hey Jude, Elton John's Your Song, Tiny Dancer, and Leave On, Harry Nilsson's cover of Bad Fingers Without You, Queen's first 3 albums, including Killer Queen and The Seven Seas of Rye, Carly Simon's You're So Vain, Loving You's the Right Thing to Do, Lou Reed's Transformer album, probably best heard on Perfect Day, mention Bowie's classics like Life on Mars and Changes.
Another one.
Plus George Harrison's All Things Must Pass album.
Another one.
Supertramp's Crime of the Century. Early Genesis albums. Woo! And so many more. And what has become of this instrument, you may ask? Well, this breaks my heart. While the piano was being moved, the cradle that was supporting it broke, and this priceless instrument tumbled into the basement of the studio and had to be rebuilt, permanently altering its sound. And it was sold at auction in May 2011, but the details of the price and purchaser have never been made public, although it's rumored to have been sold for between £300,000 and £400,000, so around $400,000 and $600,000 in American dollars. Somewhere out there is a piece of rock and roll history, and as I say in every episode, it belongs in a museum.
You know, if you ever think you're having a bad day at work, imagine being the guy who f***ed up that piano.
God. Oh, man. Oof. I mean, you can tell. I mean, it's such a distinctive sound. I mean, think about those Elton John records. Think about, Life on Mars. I mean, it definitely, that's such a sound of like early 70s FM rock. It's, God. Anyway, One of my favorite tracks on Ziggy Stardust is Moon Age Daydream, specifically because I love the unusual sax recorder duet on the solo. And I always thought that was just Bowie being weird. Yeah. I always thought that was just Bowie being weird, but apparently it has a precedent. He apparently took the idea, or borrowed the idea, I should say, from the B-side of the 1960s Hollywood Argyle number one hit, Ali Oop. You know Ali Oop, right?
What did you just say to me?
All right, I guess not. The B-side was called Show Know a Lot About Love, and there's a baritone and a flute playing the same line together all through it. And but on Moon Age Daydream, Bowie's playing a recorder and a baritone sax. He played them both himself. He got his first instrument was the sax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned earlier that some of the vocal takes from that first recording session sounded weird, so they took this one a minor third lower than the first time they tried it, because the original key was just way too high for him. But it's funny, he does return to this technique frequently. He loves putting his voice through like hell. I mean, the famous one is Heroes, where they set up the microphone successively farther and farther away from him every verse. So he had to belt louder and higher every time to get heard. And it's just, oh God, that's one of the best songs ever. God love him. God love him for wrecking his voice for us. Because I don't know, you listen to some of those later live recordings and it's like, yeah, well, that and the cocaine. You put that much cocaine down your vocal cords, they're not going to do what they're supposed to do. But yes, God love him for suffering for us, like the Christ.
I mean, you mentioned Mick Ronson's solos here. I mean, we could pick any one of the solos on this album just to dissect and gush over. I just am picking this one. You mentioned that it's just so crucial to defining this era of Bowie's sound. And Bowie summed up Ronson's musical contributions in the booklet accompanying the 30th anniversary edition of Ziggy. He said he called Mick a perfect foil and collaborator. Mick's raw, passionate Jeff Beck-style guitar was perfect for Ziggy and the Spiders. It had such integrity. You believed every note had been wrenched from his soul. And in a moment that could be viewed as thunder-stealing, because this was after Ronno had died in the early 90s, Bowie claimed that he literally drew out the shape of the solo that he wanted before every song. And the graphic that he drew with a crayon or felt-tip pen for the Moon Age Daydream solo, he described it as starting as a flat line that became a fat megaphone-type shape and ended as sprays of disassociated and broken lines. And that whole idea of visual representation of music was an idea that he borrowed from, he says he borrowed from Frank Zappa. You said that it goes back even further.
Yeah, I mean, there's like John Cage and Lamonte Young and Anthony Braxton, all these different avant-garde composers of, like, Anthony Braxton has just, like, titled his ridiculous, some of his compositions don't even have proper names. They're just, like, graphical stuff. And also, like, Frank Zappa was, like, he hand-did all of his scores, so... Yeah. I don't know how much I buy that, but sorry. Let's do a lightning round on Suffragette City.
Yeah, speaking of innovative ways to get sounds, that sound that I had always assumed to be saxophones on Suffragette City, it's not a sax. It was created by an ARP synthesizer, and Bowie wanted a larger-than-life sax sound, so he and Ken Scott, I imagine Ronno, all collaborated to create sounds that a real sax couldn't.
The ARP Odyssey, one of the most famous synthesizers of all early synthesizers, but deeply famous sound. You have heard it on Rocket Man, Chameleon by Herbie Hancock, the Doctor Who theme, Zappa stuff, Kraftwerk, DeVoe, Yellow Magic Orchestra, which is Ryuichi Sakamoto's first band. I mean, it is, people are obsessed with the ARP. And yeah, so if that sound sounds familiar to you, it justifiably is. Thank you for taking that detour with us. Let's talk about Mott the Hoople.
Yes, I didn't realize this. Before recording it himself, Bowie offered Suffragette City to Mott the Hoople, who were an English band that he loved, but they were about to break up. And to try to persuade them not to, he offered them several songs and offered to produce them. They refused to take Suffragette City, but instead grabbed All the Young Dudes, which became a huge hit, thanks in large part to Bowie's not only his songwriting skills, but his production work. And I think
he's on there. My beloved wife and I had a semi-fight about this because we were listening to the Glastonbury set, and then we went back and listened to the original All the Young Dudes, and I was like, yeah, that's Bowie on there. And she's like, no, it's not. We looked it up. It is like a scratch vocal, I think a guide vocal.
Yeah.
That ends up still on there. But yeah, you can hear him. Oh boy, Heigl's slang corner. Please, Jordan, give it to me.
Yes, Heigl, I know, given your tireless research into the slang found on Aretha Franklin's version of Respect, I thought you might like this dive into the famous wham bam thank you ma'am exclamation on Suffragette City. The line is the title of a track on Charles Mingus's 1961 album, Oh Yeah, Oh Yeah, which would have been very familiar to Bowie because he was a massive jazz fan. And according to Mingus, the phrase wham, bam, thank you, ma'am was something that his drummer Max Roach used to say when he was, quote, unable to express his inner feelings.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. And David is believed to have borrowed the Hey Man backing vocal from the Velvet Underground's 1968 song White Light, White Heat. And this brings us to the album's epic closer, Rock and Roll Suicide, which blends a lot of different influences, James Brown and Jacques Brel, somehow. Probably the only overlap I can ever think of these two people. Bowie has suggested that the French poet Baudelaire helped inspire the lyrics, but there's also believed to be connections to a poem by Manuel Machado called, help me with this,
Chants Andalou, which is probably a reference to Un Chien Andalou, which is the
Man Ray?
No, it's Buñuel, I think.
Oh, yeah.
That's the Slicing Up Eyeballs one.
Slicing Up Eyeballs!
The Pixie song reference it.
But you say there's a problem with this.
Yeah, so the poem has the line, life is a cigarette, cinder, ash, and fire. Some smoke it in a hurry, others savor it. It's in the Peter Doggett book, which is, I think it's called Man Who Sold the World, David Bowie in the 70s. And he is actually talking about another obsessive Bowie fan's research on this. But he points out that David Bowie could not read Spanish as of 1972 and that no English translation of the poem existed at this point. So that is one Bowie fan fact-checking another Bowie fan, brought to you by two other Bowie fans. So we're now entering recursive Bowie fandom. Or maybe it's like a
fractal.
Yeah, or a human centipede.
But the line, oh no, love, you're not alone, likely references the Jacques Brel song, You're Not Alone, which appeared in the musical Jacques Brel's Alive and Well and Living in Paris. I love Jacques Brel. I came to his music mostly through Scott Walker, who did tons of his songs. I think he might have even done an album that was just Jacques Brel covers.
Yeah,
and sure Bowie did. Was a huge Scott Walker fan. He was even in the Scott Walker documentary, 30th Century Man, a few years ago, which, well, I guess 15 years ago by now, which is
Play
awesome.
Cool.
Yeah. And Bowie loved Jacques Brel and performed his song My Death during some of the Ziggy Stardust live shows. He's also performed, I think he performed Amsterdam at the BBC, a number of his songs. So Jacques Brel, big influence on Bowie. But in addition to this French torch ballad, Bowie also claims that Rock and Roll Suicide was influenced by James Brown's Try Me and Lost Someone. He calls them loose inspirations, which is, again, I just think a crazy melding of influences. And he talked about this later. He gave an interview to Performing Songwriter, and he said, what I enjoyed was being able to hybridize these different kinds of music somewhat. It wasn't obviously a 50s pastiche, even though it had that rhythm that said total 50s, but it actually ends up as being a French chanson. That was purposeful. I wanted that blend to see if it would be interesting, and it was interesting. Nobody was doing that, at least not in the same way.
So now that we've gone through some of the songs individually, let's talk about Ziggy Stardust as a whole. It's often touted as a concept record, but it was never really conceived as such. The working title was Round and Round, which is a Chuck Berry cover that was recorded, but I don't think, was it released in one of those mammoth gargantuan reissue sets?
It's definitely out there, but yeah, okay. It was originally included on an early track listing for, the early version of what was ultimately became Ziggy Stardust.
As was the Port of Amsterdam cover by the Jacques Brel song and Velvet Goldmine, which later becomes the Todd Haynes movie. And another song, did I mention Holy Holy? Another song called Holy Holy. They didn't fit the Ziggy thing, so they got cut.
Well, it wasn't so much that they didn't fit the Ziggy thing. It was just they, according to Ken Scott and members of the band, there was really no discussion of a plot or any kind of, you know, overarching concept while they were recording this. And David basically admitted as much years later. He said that he basically assembled an album of tracks that fit together thematically. And the whole theme kind of emerged slowly, but it wasn't really a premeditated thing.
Yeah, so it starts to emerge as a picture once stuff is getting cut. And essentially, the linchpin to this is Starman, which is a last-minute addition, which boggles my mind. The RCA execs listened to an early acetate version of the record, and as every exec must do at one point in their life, say, "Where's the single?" To their trained ears, it lacked something catchy enough to go number one with a bullet. So David went off and wrote a song. He bumped the Chuck Berry cover, and... Starman, it references Space Oddity, which he possibly did to tweak the suits because that was his biggest hit at the point. But, you know, it had a lot of other things that went in there. It has T-Rex. We didn't talk about Mark Bolan, but he's obviously a big rival slash influence on Bowie at the time.
Old friend. They've known each other since like the mid-60s, and they're basically frenemies. The yellow patent leather shoes that Warhol was so obsessed with were a gift from Mark Bolan.
And it's got the guitar figure from You Keep Me Hanging On by the Supremes. And it also has a bit of a Judy Garland nod. You know, that chorus has the octave jump from Over the Rainbow. And apparently...
Oh, do it for us. Somewhere.
And apparently he combined them at one point. He did a live performance at one point. He interpolated Somewhere Over the Rainbow into Starman.
I've never heard that.
That's, I think, in the David Bowie in the 70s book. And with Starman, the narrative coheres. The story becomes this idea of a visionary poet named Ziggy who attempts to save Earth, which is headed toward destruction, ultimately only to be deified and destroyed by ego and rock and roll excess. And, you know, this is not a move that occurs without precedent. The Beatles had pioneered this meta idea of portraying a fictitious group on Sgt. Pepper's. The Who had made their rock opera Tommy. But Bowie commits to the bit. Is what he does more than, you know, he goes method, basically. The structure of the record is a meta commentary on the structure of a rock record. Right,
while perfecting the rock
record. Well, yeah,
record,
and also being an A-plus rock record. You know, you have all these couched political themes like the end of the world, organized religion, extraterrestrials, the alienating nature of fame, and it comes at the right time because by 1972, we're into the me decade. The optimism of the 60s has died. You've got increasing social unrest, economic, ecological uncertainty. England is into the recession that sort of begets the punk movement, record-breaking unemployment, near constant striking, and coupled with the fact that they're, what, 15 years out of World War II, so just everything is still bombed to shit. Constant power outages because the grid isn't working. And so it's a very real possibility that Bowie thought there were 5 years left. And whether or not he did believe it, he committed to the bit. There's a critic named Paul Trinka who called Ziggy Stardust a tribute to artifice, a play on identity, an alter ego placed on an alter ego. It had been in David's mind since he first gushed over a guy that he thought was Lou Reed. A star was whatever people thought you were.
As you meditate on that, we'll be right back with more Too Much Information after these messages.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
But no man is just a concept.
I am. a pillar of salt. Yeah. Continue.
Where did Ziggy Stardust himself come from? Let's dive into the specific influences that Bowie pulled to create this alter ego. First and foremost, aliens. Bowie loved aliens. Aliens were one of his enduring passions. It stretched back to his childhood when he would sneak downstairs after bedtime to watch episodes of the BBC's Quatermass Experiment on TV, which was this pioneering sci-fi show. And it was one of Bowie's very favorites. And as a boy, he really came to believe that aliens were watching him, studying his habits. He began to wonder if he might be one of the light people, who were allegedly an alien-bred race of super people who were supposed to include luminaries like Galileo, Churchill, and Isaac Newton. And by the late 60s, he was contributing to London UFO newsletters and even went UFO spotting on his roof. I love this. I don't know how this would help with UFO spotting, but he would point a wire coat hanger at the sky for long stretches. I guess I don't know what that did. But a neighbor saw him doing this and yelled up asking if he got transmission from BBC Two because he looked like a TV antenna. And he stopped doing it soon after because he was embarrassed.
Aww.
But the subject of aliens still really fascinated him, and this topic showed up frequently in his new songs. So aliens is a big one. Also, Iggy and Lou, his new friends. When composing the story of a starman who fell to Earth, Bowie was inspired by real-life fallen stars, these grandiose yet tragic figures who traveled too far down the road of excess and lost their way. And the most obvious of these is Iggy Pop, who we talked about earlier. It was really come on hard times in this period. And he'd really become something of an obsession to Bowie over the last year. He'd obtained footage of Iggy performing at, I think it was the Cincinnati Festival in 1970. It's very famous early Iggy footage.
It rules.
Yeah, it's on YouTube. It rules. There's
the one where he's wearing the silver gloves and literally, it's that famous photo of him pointing with one hand when he's held aloft by the crowd.
Yeah, it's like, ugh. I think it's like the moment the crowds, well, it probably isn't the moment that crowd surfing was born, but one of the most incredible early examples of crowd surfing. And Bowie would watch this footage repeatedly on a reel-to-reel projector at his house. And this footage inspired him, but it also really haunted him because on film, Iggy looked like a feral god. He's shirtless. And again, he's being held aloft by his, you know, his legion, his disciples. And now Iggy could barely summon the strength to leave the couch that had become his home. This Iggy character that Jim Osterberg had created had gone haywire and nearly killed his creator. It was a rock and roll suicide in a sense. And so that was a big inspiration for the inner workings of Ziggy Stardust. And to a lesser extent, David was also inspired by Lou Reed, who is, again, now living with his parents out on Long Island in a state of self-imposed exile from music. Both Lou and Iggy had become victims of the industry and also their own idolatry. And this was really par for the course for 1971, which is a really rough year for music. In the last 3 years, you had the deaths of Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and Jim Morrison, not to mention the kind of abdication of Pink Floyd founder Syd Barrett, Fleetwood Mac's Peter Green, and the Beach Boys' Brian Wilson. They all stepped back to deal with increasingly debilitating mental illness. Interestingly, some have thought that the line in the title track, "Ziggy played guitar, he played it left hand, but made it too far," was a reference to Jimi Hendrix, who was also left-handed. So David had seen the hazards of rock and roll at close range. And during his first trip to Los Angeles, he had met this guy, Gene Vincent, who was an early rock and roll pioneer. His song Bebopalula is like, you know, one of the sacred texts of early rock. And Gene Vincent was only 35, but when Bowie met him, he was looked just really old and sickly, and his body had just been mangled from years of hard living. And just a few weeks before Bowie entered the studio to begin work on Ziggy Stardust, Gene Vincent died. And so that, I think, on some level impacted Bowie. And Bowie also borrowed Gene Vincent's movements on stage. He developed a limp from a car crash, Gene Vincent did. And David used Gene's hobble as part of some of his early Ziggy Stardust stage moves. And he called the hobble a first position for Ziggy Stardust.
It's a ballet reference, right?
Yeah. But the unlikely link between down-and-out musicians and messianic aliens can be found in the story of an early British rocker named Vince Taylor. And Vince Taylor is best known today for recording the original version of The Clash's Brand New Cadillac, which is Vince Taylor's version rules. But in the early 60s, he had a brief moment of being poised to be kind of the new Elvis in Europe. At least that's how they were promoting him. But in the mid-60s, he started suffering a series of really distressing mid-concert breakdowns, culminating one night when he appeared on stage in white robes and informed the crowd that he was, in fact, Jesus Christ. And the incident pretty much killed his career, and he filled his days wandering the coffee shop scene in the London district of Soho, basically ranting at anyone who would listen. And it was there that he met a pre-fame David Bowie, and they got to know each other a little bit, and David would always remember Vince spreading out a crumpled map onto the sidewalk outside of a crowded subway station and pointing out various UFO landing sites across Europe. So this was a guy who was, to use Bowie's own words, out of his gourd, totally flipped, not playing with a full deck at all. But he remained in David's mind as, quote, an example of what can happen in rock and roll, midway between an idol and a cautionary tale. And brings us to kind of the most personal influence of Ziggy Stardust, his brother, his half-brother, Terry. And the topic of madness was always a very compelling theme for Bowie, given the streak of mental illness that ran throughout his own family, especially his half-brother, Terry. And Terry's a really fascinating figure in Bowie's life. He looms like a specter throughout it. He's kind of was haunted by him forever. Terry was much older than David, and David looked up to him as a hero, as a little boy, and Terry turned him on to art and jazz and beat poetry and all the stuff that David really loved as a teen. But by his early 20s, Terry started displaying symptoms of schizophrenia, which worsened dramatically as the years went on, and he died by suicide in the 80s, laying down in front of a train. And David always felt this streak of what he called madness in himself, and frequently cited his music and the multifaceted personas that he had as a way of keeping his sanity in check. And he once said, "One puts oneself through such psychological damage in trying to avoid the threat of insanity. As long as I could put those psychological excesses into my music and into my work, I could always be throwing it off." So Vince Taylor forced David to confront both his greatest dreams of rock stardom and also his deepest fear of insanity. And I would say that more than any one person, Vince Taylor was probably the guy who inspired Ziggy the most.
And so with that, we have pinned down, or at least mapped out, the soul of Ziggy. But let's talk about the name. You know, it's easy to assume that Ziggy is just the word Iggy with a Z, but David has said a number of things about it. He told Rolling Stone at one point that it was just one of the few Christian names he could find beginning with the letter Z, which I guess, fair. Sure, convenient.
Zachary then, Stardust doesn't have the same.
Zane. Oh, that actually kind of works.
Actually, yeah, that's not bad.
Then in an interview in Q magazine in 1990, he said that it came from a tailor shop called Ziggy that he passed on a train, and that he glommed onto it because it had the Iggy connotation, but it was a tailor shop. And so he said, well, this whole thing is going to be about clothes. So it was my joke calling a character Ziggy, because Iggy Pop famously is only 50% clothed at any given time, possibly 30%. Jamie, can we pull up those numbers? But Stardust, where do we get Stardust from? Stardust is a nod to an offbeat American singer known as the legendary Stardust Cowboy, aka Norman Carl Odom. It's something approaching a country sci-fi Tiny Tim will get you in the neighborhood of his whole shtick.
Are you into him?
I think you've talked him in as much as you have exposed me to him. Odom had released a charmingly bizarre country sci-fi single called I Took a Trip on a Gemini Spaceship in 1969, the same year as Space Oddity, and even on the same label. David was given some of his singles by people at the record company, and much like Pork, the play, not the food stuff, it blew his mind. When someone asked Odom why he added legendary to his name as a teen, he replied, I am a legend in my own time, which is very, very Bowie. And it's got this great mixture of old and new. You know, you've got Stardust, which to people of this generation, probably first thing that leaps to mind is the jazz standard by Hoagie Carmichael. But it is also, in a very literal sense, the dust from stars. And the other important reference that comes around this time from that is Woodstock. You know, Carl Sagan is coming into vogue at this time, and he's recently popularized the notion that if all matter from the universe is descended from what was present at the time of the Big Bang, then we are really, essentially, matter from stars. We are stardust. And so it's that line in Woodstock that everyone loves so much.
I take it that you don't like the Joni Mitchell song Woodstock.
It's fine. No, I mean, it gets into a little, I love Carl Sagan, but it gets into a little of that hippy-dippy stuff for me, which we are all nothing. I'm too much of a nihilist to buy into that.
It's a cool name for a project like Ziggy Stardust because, mm-hmm. you know, the whole idea of Stardust, things that have existed for millions of years being recycled and reformed. That's yes. kind of what Bowie's doing, you know, with Ziggy Stardust. It's an amalgam of familiar but disparate elements.
Yeah, what he called a grand kitsch painting.
Put that on my tombstone.
Yeah, right. I mean, look, you can play spot the influence with Bowie, but some people would just call that spot the steal. Almost everyone in his life at some point has said like, oh, he got that from me, right? Like he got a different element of a different era from me. Mick Jagger would famously joke, never wear a pair of new shoes in front of David, which I don't think was a joke. But anyway, David, bringing this all back to the legendary Stardust Cowboy, David had become a lifelong fan of him, and he covered the I Took a Trip on a Gemini Spaceship song on his 2002 album Heathen, which surely put some badly needed royalties in the coffers of Mr. Cowboy. and they met that year for the very first time after Bowie had obsessed over him for 30 years, and he reportedly completely fanboyed out, which is just truly adorable.
So, you know, I mean, say what you will about Bowie and his, you know,
magpie
his borrowing. Yeah, he was a true music fan. And when he loved somebody, he really went to bat for him and tried to help him when he could. He could meet dignitaries or whatever all day long. But when he met an artist who really touched him, it showed. And I always thought that was cool. I love it when artists stay fans. So we have the name. We have the soul. The clothes. Everyone knows that it's the clothes that make the man, or in this case, the star man. For inspiration, thank you very much. For inspiration, Bowie looked towards the futuristic minimalist outfits worn in Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange, which had been released in 1971, only to be promptly banned in the UK. Specifically, he loved the look of the droogs, the androgynous teenage thugs whose crisp white outfits underscored their ruthless brutality. David would later say, I wanted to take the hardness and violence of those outfits and soften them up by using the most ridiculous fabrics. And they assembled outlandish jumpsuits from cloth obtained at London department stores and vintage furniture fabric. And the end result was very kind of charmingly homemade looking, at least the early versions of the Ziggy Stardust outfits. Bowie would later admit it was a cross between the Jinsky and Woolworths, something cobbled together from whatever was lying around. And the look was finished off with a pair of knee-length wrestling boots done up in fire engine red. And he debuted the look at his 25th birthday party on January 8th, 1972, a fitting start to a new year that would be defined by Ziggy, at least in his life. David might have been very enthusiastic about dressing up as a flamboyant androgynous alien, but his band, Not so much. These were all tough guys from Northern England, and when they first got a look at these new outfits, their initial reactions were variations of, I'm not wearing that. Mick Ronson moaned, I'm a musician. I've got friends that are going to watch me. And again, he was a hard man from Hull, this rough industrial town in Northern England. So he was horrified, and he was so horrified that he actually packed his bags and headed to the local train station, intent on quitting the band for good, apparently just before a gig. And drummer Woody Widmansey spent an hour on the train platform coaxing him back into the fold. But after the rapturous response from audiences, particularly the ladies in the audience, to these new outfits, they all very quickly warmed to the idea of these crazy clothes. And David would later say, when the guys realized how many girls they could pull and they looked so outlandish, they took to it like fish to water. They never had so many women in their lives, and so they got tardier and tardier. And
not later and later, they got sluttier and sluttier looking.
He and Bowie used reverse psychology to get these gruff guys to wear makeup, telling them that it would make them look normal under the bright spotlights. So there was always this mad dash for mascara before showtime, which
Trevor Boulder also, in addition to being a great bassist, one of my favorites from the era, probably the best set of mutton chops in rock and roll.
Yeah.
They're
They
look like badgers growing out of the side of his face.
Very true.
Good Lord. Yes, sorry, yes, yes. As you were.
No. Well, speaking of hair, the hair came last. Ziggy's famous hair came indirectly from David's mother, which is very strange, especially, we don't have time to get into this in this episode, especially considering their difficult relationship.
For more, check out David Bowie, Off the Record, available from the iHeartRadio app.
Thank you. Thank you very much. David's mother, Peggy, had her hair done by a local hairdresser named Susie Fusey, I think is her name, who would later become Mick Ronson's wife. And David's mom passed along Susie's name to David's wife, Angie, who came in one day to get her hair cut. She got a spiky new do. It was dyed red, white, and blue, and very unmissable, just like Angie herself. And Angie was thrilled with Susie's work and suggested that she come back to their house to see what could be done with David's shaggy locks, which she deemed two Rod Stewart-ish. That's a quote, and a good one. And it's funny. I mean, unlike the rest of David's style, it really hadn't evolved much from his 60s folk hippie period. And Susie suggested that David get a haircut too, and David was open to it. And he started looking through magazines to try to find the look that he wanted. And the end result was a blend of a few different fashion spreads. One was model Christine Walton in the August issue of Vogue, and also a bit of Kansai Yamamoto's shoot in Harper's, where he used a red kabuki lion's wig to great effect. And that's not the last time we'll talk about Kansai Yamamoto, the great Japanese fashion designer. So Susie got out her razor and started slicing out this elaborate feathered style, which is puffy in some places and spiky in others, like a sci-fi peacock. And a few weeks later, he would famously dye his locks red hot red. That was the color marked on the dye. And the whole Ziggy Stardust look was in place.
I can't believe he still had hair after what they put that hair through. That dye had 30 volume peroxide in it. And then on top of that, she used an anti-dandruff treatment called Guard, like over-the-counter anti-dandruff, to help it stiffen and stay in place. Like, my
just
God.
Just pre-gel.
That man, vocal cords, hair, he put everything through the ringer, including his dick, as we'll talk about later. I don't have a segue for this next one. Going from there.
The look was in place. Time to capture it for posterity.
There you go. The cover for Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars was shot January 13th, 1972 at photographer Brian Ward's studio in Little Mews in central London. They did a few studio shots with the band before Ward suggested that David accompany him outside to the street. It's the golden hour. He wants to make the most out of the last bit of natural light. But it was a cold and rainy winter night. And David had the flu, so he didn't want to walk too far. He wanted something that evoked a Brooklyn Alley scene, so he grabbed Mick Ronson's guitar. They walk a few doors down from the studio to 23 Hedden Street, and David stopped, rested his foot on the stoop, and four snaps. That is a tremendously high batting average of film to iconography. 5years.com, which is the insanely detailed Bowie fan site, has suggested that some of the inspiration from the cover came from Michael Powell's proto serial killer film from 1960 called Peeping Tom, which is about a London photographer who kills his subjects with a knife hidden in his camera tripod. It's like up there with Psycho as far as like the early slasher cinema. So make of that what you will. Now, let's talk about the sign. Let's get even more granular and weird with it. Bowie is photographed standing outside of a fur dealer called K West, which you can see on the cover. And as fans are wont to do, project all kinds of stuff onto that. They have theorized that it was a code for Quest, as in Galaxy Quest. Great movie. We should do an episode on that. Yeah. Bowie loved it because it added a sort of, you know, he loves all this meaning, data, layers of interpretation stuff. So, of course, he loves that. But the good furriers of K West did not. They threatened RCA with legal action, writing a letter that read in part, "Our clients are furriers of high repute who deal with a clientele generally far removed from the pop music world. Our clients certainly have no wish to be associated with Mr. Bowie or this record, as it might be assumed that there is some connection between our client's firm and Mr. Bowie, which is certainly not the case." Incredibly British. But they did come to appreciate the steady flood of tourists who came to photograph their storefront until they closed in the early 90s. And we're coming into It Belongs in a Museum Part 2. The original K West sign was, quote, retrieved by a Bowie fan after one night out on the tiles in 1982. This is according to the aforementioned 5years.com. They published an email exchange with this fan, as well as his pictures of the sign. He claims that it was so badly damaged when he took it that this was an act of preservation. He said, it, quote, "it wouldn't have lasted a heavy storm." So it was ultimately restored and exhibited as part of a David Bowie exhibition in 2012. Which is close enough to a museum to probably satisfy you, huh?
Yeah, it's getting there, yeah.
And the same year that exhibition landed, a heritage plaque was placed at the site of the former K West Furriers, marking it into perpetuity as the place that Ziggy crashed to Earth. Now it's time to take the show on the road. The first Ziggy show is on January 29th, 1972, at the Friars Aylesbury, not far where Kubrick had filmed the subway attack scene in A Clockwork Orange. People paid 60 pence a ticket to see Bowie, who is amusingly, if not humbly, billed as the most beautiful person in the world. Sure. Only an hour from London, so many kids made the pilgrimage, and among them were Freddie Mercury and Roger Taylor, names you may recognize from a little group called Queen. And if they were looking for inspiration for a theatrical, larger-than-life band fronted by a weird alien sex god, they certainly found it. Let's set the stage, literally and metaphorically. The lights go down. Wendy Carlos's synthesized version of Ode to Joy from the Clockwork Orange score blares from the PA. Strobe lights. Trevor Boulder and his sideburns appear. Mick Ronson and his cheekbones appear. And they're all dressed in metallic cat suits. The drummer was also there. Woody Woodmansey was also present. They launch into Hang On To Yourself, their opening tune, as Bowie struts on stage with his spiky red hair, paler than death himself, diamond-patterned one-piece, red wrestling boots. I mean, I don't know. I'm surprised people's heads didn't actually literally explode. This blend of costume, choreography, drama, all couched within the context of a rock and roll show, nothing short of revolutionary. And then you have, I feel like we just keep coming away from this. The songs, the bangers, banger after banger. First time, live and in the flesh. And people went apeshit. They swarmed his dressing room. They wanted to know where he cut his hair. They wanted to know where he got his clothes. Some people just wanted to touch him. One girl was so overcome with emotion that she punched him, which sounds like something she should work out with her therapist. And the next day, the headline about the show literally read, "A Star is Born." Not a stretch to call this one of the most far-reaching moments in live rock and roll history. You know, you got your James Brown at the Apollo, you got Duke Ellington at the Cotton Club, you got Miles Davis at Newport, we got Zeppelin at Earl's something.
Dylan at Newport.
Dylan at Newport, yeah.
Beatles on Sullivan.
Yep, Beatles on Sullivan. Bowie at the Friars Aylesbury. Anyway, the effects of that night would ripple outward, touching on virtually every aspect of popular culture, not just music, but film, fashion, social and sexual mores, and the very nature of 20th century fame itself. You know, you could call it the night the 70s began. Couldn't you, Jordan?
I think you could, yes. You absolutely could. And I think that it's here that we should leave you all, dear listeners, for today. Ziggy Stardust is born. Hallelujah. Rejoice. We'll talk about how the Star Man made a star out of David and inspired generations of artists on part two of Too Much Information, Ziggy Stardust Edition. Heigl, what do you think?
I am so excited. And all of you dear people should be as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening. My name's Jordan.
And I'm Alex.
Join us here next time for part two. Too Much Information was a production of iHeartRadio.
The show's executive producers are Noel Brown and Jordan Runtog.
The supervising producer is Mike Johns.
The show was researched, written, and hosted by Jordan Runtog and Alex Heigl.
With original music by Seth Applebaum and the Ghost Funk Orchestra. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review. For more podcasts on iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The hit movie Bob Marley, One Love, is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Celebrate the life and music of an icon who inspired generations through his message of love, peace, and unity. If you missed Bob Marley, One Love in the theaters, now's your chance to watch at home. Stream the hit movie now on Paramount Plus, rated PG-13. Head to ParamountPlus.com/OneLove to try it free now.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.